Welcome to the Questionable Behavior Podcast. Please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at @_QBPC. Also, give us 5 stars on every podcast platform. Go on YouTube, subscribe, tell your friends, Google us, you'll find us. We got a special guest with us tonight, second episode in a row with a talented Albanian on the show. You know, we're trying to be very patriotic these next couple of episodes. So we got Edon Mola in the building, singer, QBBC. Songwriter, producer, all around great guy and huge talent. First things off, we're going to start it off with a couple of, you know, achievements in a sense. So you almost got 500,000 views on YouTube. You've gotten, just your last video, you have over 100,000 views in Dance With Me. You have, I believe you've hit over 1 million streams now on all platforms, if I'm not mistaken, only on your last album.
Correct? Only on my last album, man.
We're not even talking about the first album. So just in regards to that, you know, we're going to clap it up a little bit. Just so you guys know why he's important and why he should be here.
Not important. No one's important.
He's very important.
There's no one that is ever important, except for you. Oh, you're important because you bring people audience.
I'll take that. Well, you bring people on audience too, man. But so just to start things off, right? We've heard the story a little bit with how you started singing and all that. So now what I wanted to do is kind of get more into the details of how you were working with the Grammy-winning artist, Rebecca Flack. She kind of came at a perfect time in your life when you were already singing and gave you that extra push to really pursue. At least from our conversation, that's what I got out of it. So she gave you that extra push and that training that I'm sure took you to a whole new level as a singer. So what I wanted to ask is just that the specifics on how you guys were working together, what she taught you, and from before and done working with Rebecca Flack to after, what were the significant changes that you noticed in yourself?
Yeah, I think it's hard to like describe it. It wasn't so much training in the sense, I don't know, should I be looking at the camera or should I be looking at you?
Either or.
Okay.
We'll look at each other.
Perfect. It's a romantic podcast, guys.
We got the candles out.
So basically the training wasn't so much like her teaching me how to sing or how to write songs. It was more of a confidence boosting scenario where she saw talent that I didn't recognize because I wasn't around music the way I was. I played sports my entire life.
Yep.
So I was able to recognize talent in a sports kind of athletic way, but musical talent, I didn't know anything about. So I spent so many hours working on music before I met Roberta Flack for fun. I just enjoyed creating music or learning guitar, piano, singing. It was never anything that I ever thought would be a career.
Yeah. So what you're saying is basically you just, at that moment, even though you were practicing, you know, singing and playing the guitar, et cetera, you just didn't understand what it was that was good about you yet. And she kind of brought that to light for you in that sense.
For sure. I think the thing though, so when I sang to her, in my head, I had all the confidence in the world because it's kind of like when you start something, it's this weird dynamic of like people that are really talented. I'm not saying I'm really talented at this point. Just
okay.
One
you could be cocky. You could be cocky. It's not. Fine.
So people that are really talented understand, are more in their head about, am I good or am I not? People who don't actually have very much talent and don't recognize like how hard someone has to work to become good are very confident. So
that's true.
At this point, I was not talented, but I was very confident.
You're more confident
than I was talented. I was more confident then than I am now in music, which is the irony.
But I guess it also it comes down to like kind of just breaking down yourself and allowing yourself to just keep learning and understanding that you'll never really learn and to perfectionism.
For sure.
Which is a great part of it all, that process of continually improving and learning more. So.
Exactly. But I had fake confidence. And what I mean by that, before I met her, I would say to myself, like, I'm going to get really good. That was my message to myself. I'm going to get really good. I'm not there yet, and I'm nowhere near being great, but I'm going to get really good, and this is how I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And then when she met me and I met her, the conversation was, holy shit, dude, like, you don't understand how good you can be. Mm. And it was that, like, you can be that was so remarkable to me. Like, here, like saying it to yourself is one thing, but when someone's won like 10 or 15 Grammys and is considered one of the greatest songwriters of all time, telling
she,
you.
If you guys don't know, she made Killing Me Softly. That's, I guess, one very popular song, which was sampled afterwards. But that's her, you know, that's multiple times sampled song. And that's like a huge, huge song in music in general.
For sure. She's wrote songs for Michael Jackson, the Beatles, like Paul McCartney, Nina Simone were best. They were really.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Wow.
She wrote tons of massive hits, Mm-hmm. So yeah, having her say you can be great, and these are artists that you already are sounding better now, and you don't even understand music, period.
Yeah.
And in my head, I'm like, holy shit! Like, one, I need to work a lot harder than I am, because it was just fun, and it was something I was doing maybe 2-3 hours a day just for fun. So past that point, I was like, dang, like, I love music. I know that, but...
And this person's telling me, you know, it's giving me the hope that I can actually make it in this field, right?
Exactly. Before then, it's like, you don't see a path. You mm-hmm. don't even think about a path. You're just like, all right, I'm going to play music in my room and it's going to be fine. That'll be it.
Yeah, there's no goal there. You don't know where you're taking it. You're just, all right, I'm going to keep getting better at it.
Exactly. You just do it for fun. I mean, I still do it just for fun, but there's a, more of a path and...
trying idea to, on what to improve on and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, speaking about that, well, you're one of the people that I would say is everybody. Other people talk about it too, but you're an extremely hard worker. I we were just talking about it earlier. Every time I FaceTime you, you're in front of your computer. You're working in front of the microphone. You're writing. You're creating new music and all that. So, tell me about, because you mentioned athletics earlier. So tell me about the work ethic and how you translated from athleticism to now music, and that mentality when you're pursuing basketball, did that help in any way?
For sure. I feel like I failed at basketball. I had all these achievements that on paper look really great, but I kind of always say to myself, like, if I'm not the best at something, then I'm not going to be remembered for it. And to me, the pain of failing at basketball just fueled the shit out of me. I don't know if I can curse on your podcast, but like, it just fueled me. And I don't want to fail at music. And I'm very passionate about music, and I love music more than I love basketball. And I spent 7 hours a day training as a basketball player. So it's just that many. It's the interesting thing is music is kind of, when people think of musical talent, it's either you have it or you don't. And that's bad. Like, it's the worst thing that I can think of, because it's definitely not true. Like, I didn't know how to sing. I didn't know how to play any instruments. I didn't know how to do anything. So it's really just sitting there and putting in the hours. There's no secret. Like, you get better at singing because you sing all the time.
Because you sing more. Yeah. And actually, we had a guest a couple of seasons ago. I don't even recall who it was now, but they were talking about that specific thing where even just your voice box is a muscle. So if you just keep training your muscle, it'll get better. So if you just keep practicing, you can become a better singer. Because a lot of people, they do assume, like, if I don't have the natural talent for it, then I'm not going to do it. Like, exactly. I can't do it, you know? And it stops you before you even take that first step to go forward.
Yeah. Which is great for me, because all these people don't want to start. I don't have any competition.
No competition. So, yeah. So in regards to, like, all right, so you're training, you're training your voice, you're learning guitar all on your own. Let's go back a little bit to that story in itself. One day the guitar kind of just interested you, but you didn't want to go out and spend all the money on a guitar. Not that you didn't, you just didn't have the capabilities to spend as much money on a guitar from a friend that was trying to teach you. And as you're walking out the store thinking, like, fuck, I can't afford this guitar, you find a guitar in the garbage, basically.
Basically, yeah. So I this dude, John, I'm going to say his name in every interview because
that's why
it's my guy. And he brought me to a guitar center, which was like 4 blocks away from my high school at the time. And every guitar in there was like $300 and up. And I remember him saying to me, not knowing that, like, my circumstances
situation,
or,
right.
or anything, he was just like, oh yeah, this is a cheap guitar. You can totally get this guitar. And he's like, it's only like $200 something bucks or like $300. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like,
Damn, that's a lot of fucking money.
Like, yeah, how do I tell this? Like, I don't want to see.
And you don't want to be embarrassed poor, and be like, yeah, I'm
as a
poor.
15 or 16 year old kid, you don't want to tell your friend that like you're broke and you can't afford a guitar. So you kind of make an excuse and it's like, oh, I don't really like this one. And you kind of just leave.
Yeah.
And in your head, you're like, damn, like,
I want that damn thing.
I want a guitar, but I ain't going to pay $200-$300 bucks for it.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, I'm not going to be a musician. It's like rich kid, like hobby type of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're walking maybe like another three blocks towards the school again. And we pass this pawn shop and dude's literally throwing a guitar in the trash. And I'm asking him, hey, like, what are you doing? Cause like now I just seen guitars and they're all $200-$300 bucks. And this dude's literally throwing a guitar in the trash. So I'm like,
damn, this is $200-$300 per piece. Exactly,
yeah. And he's like, you can keep it. So I asked him if I can have it. He said, it's just too expensive for him to fix the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
He would make more money throwing it in the trash, ironically, than trying to sell it and fixing it. So I bought it and just fixed it and glued like the pieces that were broken. And
that's
it.
And that's how you started learning. So when did you actually buy your first guitar?
I think it was like a year and a half past the point.
Mm-hmm.
I did everything I could on that guitar,
mm-hmm.
but without getting into technicalities, like when you have a broken neck on a guitar, the strings get really high.
Okay.
So it's harder to play higher up on the neck because as you progress through the neck, it gets more and more difficult to hold down the strings.
Oh, got it.
So everything that's simple on the guitar, it's not simple, but there's a peak of what you can learn when strings are no longer going in that direction. So a year and a half on that thing.
And then you're like, okay.
Bleeding fingers. Because really? The strings were so high, you'd have to press.
What do you mean high? Show me like on the guitar.
Yeah. So if you look at this guitar, the strings are pretty low to the neck.
Oh, got it. Got it.
The way the neck was, it was pressed up this way.
Oh, so the
string tension was.
Oh, so you have to push it much further down to even get the note.
Exactly.
Oh, so you're really. And I tried to learn a little bit of guitar during quarantine. He actually helped me out as well. And man, your fingers, like after a week of playing, they're numb. My fingers were numb. So I could imagine if you even have to press it more, like, holy shit. Like, every time for like a week of playing, everything I was touching, my fingers were like tingling. I'm like, this is what the fuck is going on. I'm like, is this what it takes?
Yeah. It's like, what did I get myself into? Yeah.
And that's kind of when you realize how, well, first of all, how like you progress in regards to learning, but you realize how hard it really is, you know? So like learning, you're sitting there and it's like so awkward at first. And that's why it's so easy to quit when you start something because it's so hard in the beginning. I couldn't even get my fingers to fucking bend the way they're supposed to bend, you know?
For sure.
And then eventually a week later, I'm like, oh, wow, I'm playing this song. All it takes is
muscle
repetition.
Memory.
Yeah, repetition.
That is literally
I didn't get to the muscle memory. I still had to look the whole time, but it's okay. we're getting there. So now in regards to like the instruments, et cetera, you more recently just learned how to play violin during quarantine.
Yes.
And to a point where you actually put the violin in a song.
Yeah, I learned violin. The reason I learned violin was for a song. I couldn't hire a violinist, and you can't fake a violin.
I was going to just say, like, why couldn't you do it in production, for example, or like with, you know, like most people would have taken that easy route and just.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to do
done it in a program like this kid, my brother that's recording right now. He's playing every instrument by clicking buttons, you know?
For sure.
So, yeah. So how come you didn't want to just do it that way and you took the hard route into actually.
So it's interesting without getting into like music production, real violin will always sound better than a programmed violin because it's a real player playing the string.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the notes that are not perfect, and then you get the scratch of the bow on the strings. So you can, you know, it's the indescribable, right? Like the reason I make music isn't because I have to, it's because I absolutely love to.
Yeah.
And I knew I wanted violin in my room where I recorded everything else, and I couldn't get a violinist in that room,
mm-hmm.
so I needed to become that violinist for that song otherwise.
And that's on Formerita?
It's on for the album Formerita, for sure. It's on Cabin in the Woods, and I think two other songs on there.
That have the violin in the background. Well, that's awesome. I mean, you learned it in a couple of months, and you actually put it into an album that you were already working on. So, you know, I'm sure that timeline of like, fuck, I got to hurry up and learn violin so I meet the date was not easy.
Yeah, it was a long nights, for sure.
So tell me like a little bit about the album in itself. When you're putting the album together, you have songs arranged in a certain way, which to me, my first reaction is it was pretty planned, the way that you had the song set up. A lot of people kind of put songs together and put it in an album, but to me, it seemed like you ordered it a certain way. So tell me about that process and you just doing the final packaging of the album before launch.
For sure. I think, it kind of was, I wanted to tell a story in a perspective of someone sitting in a chair, hypothetically mm-hmm. speaking, we're sitting in this chair right now,
mm-hmm.
and you're alone, you're just thinking to yourself, you're in your moment, so that's the intro, right? That's the moment that you're in.
Right.
And then you have a flashback to a memory. Dance With Me is the first track on it, and it's a happy memory. So typically when people have flashbacks, it's either happy or sad.
Mm-hmm.
For me, my moment was sad that I was in, so I needed a happy memory to get away from what I was currently in.
Right.
So that was the idea of starting off the album with Dance With Me.
Mm-hmm.
I needed a happy moment, which was why I wrote the song in the first place.
So now in regards to your song Dance With Me, you also have Dancing With The Devil. So do those two songs have any relation between each other? And is it, you know, are you telling us something hidden in between the lines about yourself?
For sure. I wouldn't say it's about myself, Dancing With The Devil. It could be. It could not be.
Depends who it is. Well, depends who we ask.
Yeah. So Dance With Me transitions into Dancing With The Devil, transitions into 6 a.m. They're all intertwined. There's a story behind all three of the songs
mm-hmm.
that I'm never going to tell anyone.
Not even the question. You know? We should have got him drunk first.
Because music is meant to, it's a perspective thing. You know, right. Like you hear a song, you think.
And if you tell it now, you're forcing people to think
about
way.
That. Yeah, yeah. And yeah. It's not about me. It's literally not about me at all.
It's always about the consumer, right, at the end of the day.
Yeah, so. If someone hears a song, Dance With Me, and thinks one thing, and they have this amazing thought in their brain, and mm-hmm. that's all they think about, and then I go and tell them, like, hey, this is my story, and then it's like, oh, dang, like, it's, you know, just ruined the song.
And now in regards to the album itself, you wrote everything, you produced everything, you engineered everything.
Yep.
You obviously performed it. So tell me about like just all these parts and you're a one-man team putting all these things together. Just tell me about like what it took for you to like learn all these different aspects and why not take the easy route and have someone produce it and you're just like, okay, I'm going to learn and make it sound better. Because when we discussed your first album, you critiqued yourself and said, I didn't like the way it sounds.
Yeah.
So now you took that and you did it yourself to sound better in the next album.
For sure.
Tell me about that learning process. And just, again, in regards to your discipline, because it's easy to kind of just stop learning when things get hard.
Yeah. I think it's, for me, on the first album, it was easy to make mistakes because mistakes, one, obviously, but two, it was easy to make excuses for things. And I never want to be in a position to say, Edison, you listened to my song and you didn't like Dance With Me. Mm-hmm. And then I can go back to you and say, oh, it was the producer's fault.
Mm.
It was the engineer's fault.
So you kind of just want to put everything.
If you don't like
yourself.
My song, it's because you don't like my song. Like, yeah. There's no excuses.
I
did
it. Yeah, I can't make an excuse, and this is what it is.
Yeah.
So with that being said, we're going to just take a quick break, and we'll be back.
I didn't think that I'd be seeing you here tonight. Mm-hmm. I didn't know this is where you'd go on a Saturday night when you don't want to be at home.
And we're back.
There we go. He's taking my fucking flame. My spark. You know, always trying to take the moment. We're back. They also have a gift for Edon, which is this hat.
Whoop, whoop.
Shout out to my boy at Shipe Brand. And make sure you go shop Shipe. So let's get back to, we were just talking about, you know, if anybody dislikes any of his songs in his album, it's 110% his fault. Because he made everything.
Exactly.
But that's, in itself, that's pretty ballsy, if I must say. Because you are learning something very new that you might not be perfect at yet for the reason of taking the blame on your own. You know what I'm saying?
Where, for sure.
So tell me, like, just enhance that a little bit, like that thought process of like, you know, I don't care how hard it's going to be to produce this. I don't care. I'm going to make sure it sounds the way I want it to sound.
Exactly. I think there's the first part was I couldn't afford to hire an engineer because they're like 50, 60 an hour. Then mm-hmm. a session musician is 50, 60 an hour if it's a lower tiered, you know.
Yeah.
A really good musician's like 150 an hour.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah.
And then you go beyond. But I knew I always wanted guitar on my songs. I always wanted a piano. I always wanted it to sound good, right? Like mm-hmm. everybody wants their music to sound good. But what does that really mean?
Right.
It's learning how to record is a step, first step. The second step, well, the first step is getting good at music, right? Because no matter what,
well,
like,
yeah, yeah.
anything that goes through a microphone, if it's bad,
but let's say you think you're the best right now.
Yeah, so, exactly.
You finally like progress. All day done.
So you progress and then you learn how to record and then you learn how to produce. That was at least the steps I took was mm-hmm. why doesn't anything sound good yet? So that's engineering. So I had an opportunity to go to a really nice recording studio and I recorded a song there and everything sounded great. Like I recorded everything. Someone was able to help me out and figure out everything. I spent that 2 hours though, literally every single question I couldn't figure out on my own was just drilling the engineer and the producer there. And I was like, how do you do this? Like, how do you do that? And they're like, dude, just record your song. And I'm like,
stop asking these damn questions and record. Yeah. That's what you're here
I'm
for.
I'm like, what kind of microphone is that? All right, why are you using that microphone? Like, why are you using this audio interface? Why are you using like this preamp?
Yeah.
And these people were open. So they like gave me all of their thoughts and like their process. And I was like, to be honest, like I can do this myself. Like,
yeah,
I built a studio from literally the ground up. Mm-hmm. Like we got sledgehammers and like broke walls and we built a studio from the ground up.
I think you just posted a video more recently drilling into the concrete.
Yeah. I had there's a mathematical problem when you build a studio. A box is not really great because there's so many reflections in a box. So you kind of want more of a rectangular spaced room. I went deep into like
so you're really looking at like how the sound travels in the room.
Exactly. So that was the first step is your room. The second mm-hmm. step is, you know, getting your acoustic foam and your panels and all of that. So that's the second step. And the third step is getting your equipment, learning what equipment sounds good on Edison and what sounds good on Dion. You know, everyone's unique and different. Shout out Dion on the camera. So it's really just figuring out what sounds good. And it's trial and error and tons of hours. But now I can record at any point I want, right? Yeah. So every time you call me, I'm literally recording.
Right.
If I had to travel to a studio, that's an hour to travel there, an hour to travel back. So yeah. two hours of my life.
You could do there.
Exactly.
And you don't actually have a recording booth set up. So you must have set up the room in a way where you can kind of just leave the mic in the space that it is.
Exactly.
So tell me like more in detail. Let's get a little bit on the nerdy side
of how the sound travels
so that, you know, so you get a crisp sound in an open room. Because basically it's like an open room like this and your microphone is sitting there and it's, you know, you're not really capturing any background noise. So how do you
for
do that?
Sure. So the room is actually soundproofed entirely. So from the ground up, we put Rockwell into the walls. We have double plated glass windows. And then I also have soundproof curtains. So when you record piano or you record guitar, you kind of do want some reflection in a room. So you don't want a completely dead environment when you record, let's say, a violin or an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of want that room sound. When you record vocals, you want a completely dead, silent room, but you don't want a boxy room.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing that I had to think of. How do I do both, right? So I need to record guitar, which needs a little bit of a room vibe. And to record vocals, you need a completely dead room. So those are two polar opposites.
You just have to do that all in the same room without a booth.
Exactly. So what I did was I drilled the ceiling and I drilled into the walls a rail. So I was able to hang up these soundproof curtains. So when I needed to record vocals, I pulled the curtain around
and completely in a circle. The room.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So that's your booth, basically.
Yeah, but it's kind of like the size of the room. It only cuts off the other side.
So it's around the whole room, basically. So you have like just a rod, basically. Going
exactly.
Around the room,
yeah.
And the moment you take the curtains out, it deads that space.
Exactly.
How did you think about that?
Honestly, I don't know. It just came to me. I knew that there were soundproof curtains.
And I was going to ask, these are specific curtains to absorb more sound.
Exactly, yeah, to stop reflection. So essentially, soundproof curtains don't stop sound. What they do is deaden a room, so they stop reflections.
Oh, got it.
So if you had someone speaking on the other side of the curtain,
okay.
You would still hear that person speaking on the other side of the curtain. Yes, it would be a little quieter, but you'd still hear that person. Mm-hmm. But what you really want is a room that doesn't reflect. So when you sing, the sound
it doesn't
only travels
hit and come back.
Exactly, right. It only travels.
I mean, we deal with certain issues like that with the podcast. Well, we used to, and we had different rooms and whatever.
Yeah,
but it's not to that extent. Obviously, we're not here singing and yelling.
Yeah,
unlike you. But so let's go back a little bit again to when you met on your first show. You had a first show that was basically free. And almost nobody you knew showed up. Zero people showed up, for the record. You guys are assholes. No, I'm kidding.
You said it.
So, did you delete all those numbers from your... No, I'm kidding. So,
can't from delete the, mom.
Oh, man, no.
I'm just kidding.
That's bad.
Mom
one.
And
that's
dad.
Bad one. Okay, mom, dad. Next one. They'll catch the next one. They promised.
I don't think so.
It's Albanian parents, bro. They're like, bro, we're getting to leave the guitar and get a job. What are you doing? And that's their way of support.
Oh, man.
No, I'm kidding.
Them.
But so you're there and you're by yourself performing, no support. You know, starting out as a musician, that's got to be rough at first because that's, you know, kind of that validation you get from other people, especially in the beginning, helps you kind of realize like, oh, I can keep going.
Yeah.
So you didn't have that, but you still went out, you still performed. So tell me what was that your first feeling and how did you actually feel low and stuff when you were performing or did you psych yourself out and was like, I don't care, this is my first performance.
Dude,
doesn't matter to me.
I was ecstatic. Like I didn't care if no one showed up. My first show was at Sidewalk Cafe, and if you don't know Sidewalk Cafe, it's literally where Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, like these monster musicians started out singing and performing and learned how to perform at these venues. So when I first like got the opportunity to perform there, I was like, y'all, like you don't understand this is like the most incredible thing because these other musicians, and at the time I was still doing music for fun. This was maybe like a few weeks after I met Roberta Flack. But in my head, I'm like, Jimi Hendrix played here? Like,
yeah.
It's on y'all like, if you don't want to come out.
Yeah,
and like,
you want to come? I'm excited. Yeah. Nobody has to go, but.
Dude, if no one comes to my shows, I'm still going to perform. Like,
yeah.
Even today, if no one shows up, I'm still performing.
Still the same way.
Still exactly the same
and that,
way.
You know, that I've seen certain artists that, you know, they're in a room with 1,000 people, they perform a certain way, and they're in a room with 50 people, and they still perform the same way. And that's because at the end of the day, you're getting better. So, you know, whether you're in a room with 50 people or 1,000 people, you're still going to get better if you give it your all on stage that day. So
for sure.
Yeah. And then right after that, something interesting actually happened to you. You end up meeting Ed Sheeran's manager.
Yeah. It wasn't his manager, though. It was his guitar technician.
Oh, guitar technician.
Yeah. Okay. Still such a cool guy.
Yeah.
But
and you got tickets to your first ever show, period. Your first ever concert.
First ever concert, yeah.
Right after.
Hilarious, yeah. So they were the setup of the room was you had a little concert hall and then you had a bar which was on the left side, which is really quite strange, but you walk through this little stage and then you walk to the left and you have a bar. You can't see people at the bar and the bar can't see the people at the stage.
Oh, okay.
So the guy was just sitting there listening. And I was wrapping up and I was starting to leave. And he's like, hey, man. I'm like, you were here? I'm like, that's pretty cool. At least I had somebody hear me sing.
Yeah.
And he comes up to me. He's like, I don't know if you're into like I work for this guy. His name's Ed Sheeran. And I don't know if you're into him. but if you want free tickets, he's performing in Boston, and here you go if you want to go. And I'm like, one, like, I wasn't the biggest, I didn't know much about Ed Sheeran at this point, because he, I think he was on his like plus tour, which was before he like,
became really blew up.
Yeah, exactly.
Before it was kind of like a cult following at that moment. If you knew Ed Sheeran, you really followed him. If you didn't yet,
he didn't hit
like those pop records.
I think he just got off his like tour with Taylor Swift, so he's really starting to like really blow up. So I never been to a concert in my life because they were crazy expensive, and you know, I worked like as a doorman, so there isn't. I wasn't spending $300-$400 on
just to watch someone perform. Like,
at that point. Now, heck yeah, I'll pay whatever. But
yeah,
like
now, we're going. But yeah, back then we're not fucking.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I had a test the next day. It was like a Thursday, and I called my teacher and I'm like, I'm not even gonna pretend to lie. I got free tickets to a concert and I'm gonna go. And he's like, dude, you're fine. You've passed every test with flying colors. You're good. Go have fun. And I went. I was supposed to meet him after the show, but I guess I don't know. Whatever reason, he wasn't able to meet with people afterward. So that kind of sucks, but it's a blessing because I want the first time that I meet him
To be like on the same level in a sense.
Well, I don't think,
on the same stage, let's say for the first time.
At least.
And then later, on the same level.
I'm really competitive, but like,
So, but that's awesome. So the first, you know, so even though, like, it seems like throughout your life, you just kind of had certain signs that were like, hey, you should sing.
Oh, my God, dude. When I went to that concert, it was the most amazing thing. Like, for someone who's never been to a concert, it's when you go to a sports game, half the crowd is usually split, right? Yeah. Like, you have one side for one team and one side for the other team, and it's competitive, and everyone's there, like, in your face, like, all this, like, masculinity or like, you know, toxic energy that's like that concert was literally nothing but every single person in that room just loving the shit out of music, and everyone just coming together and having a freaking awesome time. And I was like, there's nothing like this. This is what I want
to
do.
And so in regards to your performance, so at that point you're performing alone on stage, and then you go, you see Ed Sheeran, who also performs alone on stage. The first time you performed, did you always have a plan like, all right, I'm going to be on stage by myself? Or did you figure eventually maybe I'll have a band with me and whatever before you went to the Ed Sheeran show?
Like, yeah, so before I mean, I never really thought about performing on stage by myself. At this point, I was just playing guitar and piano, so it wasn't like I needed a band just yet. And there was no one at my concert, so it wasn't like this loud, ruckus room where it's where I needed a whole band to fill it out. I think the first time I realized I needed to figure something out was when I played The Bitter End, and there was probably like 150 people in a room that could probably should only fit 50 people.
Yeah.
It's like a really loud New York City bar if you don't, in a good way, like everyone's just having fun and just, you know, really drunk and really, really drunk. Not listening to the music, but
yeah, trying to. I think I met you in a similar setting. I don't know if it was in that spot, but
no, it's a similar setting for sure. And I remember, like, the host, he hired me for like a Saturday night just because at this point I was starting to bring people out, and more people were coming to the concerts, which is really awesome. But that place was so loud, and there were so many people that weren't there to see me, they were just there to like bar hop. And I was playing an acoustic guitar, and there's 150 people just screaming at each other, and it's like drowning out me as a singer. So I was like, damn, like, I got to figure out, one, how I can be louder, two, entertain people. Like, you don't want to be a sad singer-songwriter when everyone's just trying to be drunk and have fun.
So you have to kind of find the both.
Exactly. You know? So then I started to like learn how to use multiple instruments at once, which is how I started.
With the looping machine.
Exactly.
So now... You bring in the looping machine into your performances. You play the drums. You loop that. You're playing all the instruments one by one, and then just structuring together to perform your songs. Where did you get that idea from?
So there's a few artists that do it. Jack Garrett is a really good example. He doesn't do it the same way that I do. I took some of his like performance ideas, and then I also took Ed Sheeran's ability to like, use his acoustic guitar plus his his vocal harmonies, which is cool. Jack Garrett does really well drums and piano. So Ed Sheeran only does acoustic guitar and vocals. So I wanted to combine all four.
Starting these people that are successful in what they do and kind of learning from them.
Yeah, so the way I looked at it was they were pieces to a puzzle, and that puzzle would both, if you combine them both, then you could figure out how to use drums, piano, vocals, guitar, and, you know, harmonize with yourself.
Yeah. So how long ago did you bring that into your performances? And will you eventually be performing with the full band, the full, you know, background vocal? Is that your goal?
I mean, hopefully. I think everyone wants like a full orchestra kind of like scenario. You know, excuse me.
Edit that out, Dion. No.
But everyone wants the full orchestra or like the Philharmonic to be behind them performing. Hopefully I get to that point. But if I have to perform by myself, which was a necessity till now.
Yeah, you turned the necessity into, you know, your art, basically.
Yeah. Basically, yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about, like, you were actually on live with an NBA player. I'm not sure if it was Iman Shumpert. Was it? I'm not sure, but you were live playing Dance With Me. They were playing Dance With Me on Instagram.
Yeah.
I forget which player.
Andre Drummond.
Oh, Andre Drummond. Yes, yes. Okay. It was Andre Drummond. So now, basically, your goal initially before singing was to be in the NBA.
Yeah, this is hilarious.
So, and now you have an NBA player playing your song on Instagram. So tell me about how the two worlds colliding in a sense.
Full circle. So I don't quite know how, aside from my a person that I knew was at a party and played my song at that party, which Andre Drummond was at, enjoyed hearing.
Another fucking sign from the universe. Just here you go, Adam.
Yeah, right.
Just in case you thought you shouldn't sing. Yeah, you should.
Wild. So then that mutual friend hooked us up, and we met on Instagram Live, and I performed the song for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, showed a lot of love. Shout out Andre Drummond.
Yeah.
Really cool guy.
So how's that experience? Were you nervous at all? Like, all right, you know, now a lot of people, all his followings are, you know, going to be looking at you in a sense. Like, tell me about that feeling. Or is it because you're in front of a phone, it doesn't really matter too much?
Yeah, I thought it was awesome. I mean, I kind of just looked at it. I didn't even realize how many people were on the live. There's probably a lot, but like, to me, it was me and Andre Drummond just having a conversation, which is like strange to say because there's other people watching that conversation.
Yeah.
But it just felt like it was like a one-on-one, like, hey, like, you like the song? That's pretty awesome. I used to love basketball, so.
Yeah. So it's like, all right, now you have like a conversation. Yeah, you got that goal, but, you know, a few years ago, I would have beat your ass in high school.
He wants to be a rapper, though, so like.
Oh, so there we go. Maybe a track is coming soon.
Throw into that world, yeah.
Edan featuring Andre Drummond, coming soon. Coming soon. Dion, real quick, you're going to edit this out, but when, just stop it and start it again. And you're good. And then you could edit that in. You're actually started doing film scoring as well. You finished a Bollywood movie.
Yeah.
You finished the score for the Bollywood movie, and you more recently are doing some score for Amazon and Hulu.
Yeah.
So tell me about how you brought yourself to like work on movies, and was that always an idea for you?
I always loved movie scores. I think the first time I realized how powerful music is through watching film. When you watch a Disney movie and you start crying 99% of the time, it's because the music is bringing you there. And then one of my favorite, I was at a dinner a while back, it was like a few years ago, and Hans Zimmer, if you don't know who Hans Zimmer is, you guys should research him. He's like one of the most famous film composers ever.
Yeah.
And I wasn't at dinner with him. I'm still a nobody, so he's not having dinner with me. But he was at like two tables down, and I'm fangirling. Like, if there's anyone that's gonna make me fangirl, it's Hans Zimmer, just because of the level of talent is just ridiculous. So I'm sitting there, and I'm like, with the person that I'm with, I'm like, how do I say hi to him? Like, I completely forgot that I was with this person at this point. Like, I was
on a date where he's like, just stop talking. Hans Zimmer's right there. Like, why are you still talking?
And I'm like, but how do I do this? Like, how do I approach him? And then I was like, I'll wait till he goes to the bathroom. That's my plan.
Oh my God, he's followed him to the bathroom.
Dude didn't go to the bathroom the whole night.
Oh my God. You're like, oh, motherfucker, he's not getting up.
I can't go to his table.
Tell him the waiter, can you please give him more drinks?
Give him water.
Give him water or something.
Give him water. Yeah, so I didn't want to like just interrupt his dinner and be that guy.
Right.
So I was like, you know what? It's probably for the best that I didn't meet him, because maybe one day when I do meet him,
yeah,
he might know my music, hopefully. But
he will. I'm sure. Well, he's going to hear it in movies. Yeah, he's going to why didn't I make that?
So then I didn't mean to cut you off. I decided, well, first I wrote a song that got picked up by a Bollywood film. And then the person that licensed the song for the film was curious if I scored music for film. And he's like, hey, like we have a few scenes that we still need to score. Don't know if you're a film composer, but if you are, it would be great because we have a deadline to meet. And I was like, hell yeah, I'm a film composer. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, I do the same thing. If there's an opportunity, yeah, of course I do that. And it's like, oh shit, now I gotta figure out how to do that.
Dude, I didn't sleep for like 2 weeks straight.
Trying to like study now. Like,
learn how to film compose. Yeah.
So how is that process? They send you the scenes and they tell you kind of the mood they're trying to get, and then you're doing it from scratch or how?
Yeah, so the way that one worked, I got a script. I didn't get the full scenes yet because they hadn't filmed the pieces that they needed just yet.
Okay.
So it's a documentary about global warming. Mm-hmm. And they gave me the length of time and the script. So that's the way I had to start. And then they gave me the actual interviews. And I was able to score off that, which completely changed the original score. So I had to stay off an extra like.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. But it was a great learning experience, you know, like just.
So now in regards to like the more business side of things, when you're, you know, scoring for a movie, et cetera, how does the licensing and this that type of stuff work out?
Yeah, I can't go into like, of course, the
not the number details, but in regards to like, are you getting paid for this case? Are you getting paid up front? Are you going to get paid something up front plus all the times that it plays on TV, et cetera? Or how
So there's numerous ways that an artist would get paid or a film composer will get paid for a score. There's the upfront payment, and then you typically get royalties on the film, and depending on your level as an artist, that, you know, fluctuates. So you can get 2-3% of the revenue from a gross percentage, or you can get it from a net percentage. And then you also get mechanical royalties.
Right.
So every time the film is played, let's say on Netflix by 100 million people, you get $100 million. That would be nice. but you get 100 million people to listen to it. So you get, you know, the mechanical
.00
whatever it is for film. So there's usually a 3-tiered approach.
Rona, you're good. You don't have to do anything now. He's already on the new recording.
I need to change the battery.
Oh, okay, gotcha. All right, that's fine. You just have to chop that up. You got it. Rona, you can stop the audio right now.
Do I click this button?
Click the...
You can click.
Huh. Shout out, Rona.
Yeah. Oh, and her art back there. You know what I mean? We got my brother on the camera and my sister's paintings in the background.
Talented family.
So, yeah, they're definitely more talented than me. Or at least I was at their age. Huh? Your handprint is on this painting?
You see that little hand right there? That's my
hand.
Where? Right there. Where that big heart is.
Oh, right here. Oh, damn. Artistic. I didn't even realize. Yeah, it's a lot of cool stuff. The funny thing is, her paintings, you could flip them any direction and it kind of makes sense. So this was originally supposed to be this way.
I used to play this game called Kingdom Hearts. That's what that reminds me of.
But Yeah, Kingdom Hearts. I remember that classic game. He doesn't play games anymore because all that time goes into singing.
I'm a lonely man. A lonely, sad musician now.
And because when he does go out and is not lonely and is on dates, he's looking at other tables and finding Hans Zimmer. So we'll blame it on that.
I shouldn't have been at that restaurant.
It's your fault. You probably picked it out, so it's 100% your
fault. Definitely my fault.
He's going to make a song about it. No, I'm kidding.
I'm cry about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, he doesn't even cry anymore. He just makes music.
Yeah, tears don't flow out of me. They're only musical notes.
They musically come out.
Yeah, exactly.
this is, here's my musical tears. So in regards to that, a lot of songs are based on love and a past relationship, it seems. I don't know if it is past relationships. Let's say, yeah, hypothetically. But a lot of songs are based on love, based on relationships. And tell me about that in general. Did anybody from your past that you may have wrote about figure out that that's about them?
For sure. I'm very descriptive in my writing. So I think, yeah, people know who the songs are about. I would never tell anyone who the songs are about.
Have you ever had an issue in regards to that where someone was like upset?
Once, but that person never really spoke to me again. So
regardless of the fact.
Yeah. So
wait, did they never speak to you again after hearing that song? They're like, that's it?
No, it was the song came out after that person never spoke to me again. Got it.
And even after the song, she didn't.
Nope. Yeah.
Oof.
No, no.
Tough. Yeah, how about the opposite? Has it ever rekindled something?
Yeah, it has, but I'm not really a person that, like, you know, when people break up, I'm not, you know, how some...
Yeah, me, the back and forth,
I think there's
no,
usually...
No, but it rekindled kind of like a friendly relationship kind of thing, like, oh, okay, I didn't know you felt this, whatever.
100%, yeah. Yeah.
How are those conversations in general?
I think they're interesting. Art is funny because it's kind of like the cheesiest thing you can imagine to write a song for somebody.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but I've never performed a song that I've written in a room with candles and then was like, hey, like,
oh, like, yeah, yeah, like waiting like, on the bed.
Waiting on the bed, shirtless.
Petals, yeah. Like,
yeah. It was always like the song was done and out in the world. And then that person was just like, hey,
wait a
like,
minute.
Yeah, hold on.
We went on a date and we saw Hans Zimmer. Why is that in the lyric?
Exactly.
Is that me?
Exactly. So that was usually how that goes.
Yeah. So look, talk about like your writing process in general. Like when you're sitting down and you're writing a song together, how what's that process for you? Like, do you put yourself in a zone or do things just come and you just jot them down and then build from there?
I learned from a really incredible songwriter to never have things that tie you to something. So like this person, I forgot who it was specifically who said this, but they said don't do things twice, in a sense of like don't have the same candle lit, and no, you can no longer write songs without a candle being lit in the room,
because then you get stuck in that mode.
Exactly. So I kind of just, you know, if I'm walking down the street or if I'm by my piano or if I'm by my guitar and I have a cool idea that just pops into my brain, it's really just about like you get this initial idea, and usually ideas feel great in the moment, but as you progress through it, you're kind of like, oh, that's a terrible idea the next day. So it's really having the drive to be able to like sit there for hours trying to figure out, or weeks or months, and, you know, flush that idea out. Mm-hmm. So the initial idea is just random, right? Like you could be at a piano, the melody will come to your mind and that melody will make you feel something. Mm-hmm. Then comes then
you're putting away
the grind.
And like you said, you're not doing anything the same way. So, so maybe sometimes a melody comes first, another time maybe
exactly,
a lyric will
yeah.
come out first, and then you build around that. Well, that's actually very interesting because when we interviewed Timek from Poland, he's the number one artist in Poland.
Sick.
Constantly touring around Europe, etc. So initially he's like, yeah, you sit down and you write, but then you get to a point where you're on tour all the time. So he's like, literally, he's transitioned into writing on the bus while he's moving from one place to another, you know,
man,
or he's
cool.
like writing right on the spot, because that's, you don't have time anymore to just sit and write. You
yeah.
know, you lose time. As you get more successful, you lose the time to actually create.
All the time in the world, guys.
Thankfully for the quarantine, we got movies coming out, we have Amazon, we have Hulu, the quarantine probably did help a lot of people in regards to that, I'm sure.
For sure.
But, you know, that's the interesting part, that like as you gain success, you kind of lose the time to sit in a room and to actually do what made you successful to begin with. So you have to kind of like maneuver around what things are coming. So in regards to that, has like anything, what would you say has changed from the beginning on how you used to make music till now? Like what would be the major change? If you're looking back at all the done, you're like, man, I can't believe I used to do things like that.
I don't think there's anything that's changed, to be honest. Like I couldn't name anything that has changed. Like I remember the first song I've ever written. It's in my notes on my phone. And it's like the worst, cheesiest, like worst lines. So it's really nothing that's changed. My music is still really cheesy and shitty, but like, it's more of like
with a million streams. Yeah,
it's more about just putting in the hours. There's like no secret. Like I can't sit here and lie and be like, oh, I changed X, Y, and Z, and now I can write songs better. Mm-hmm. It's just I wrote really shitty songs for a long time and then continued to get better. I still write really shitty songs, but hopefully tomorrow I can write a better song, you know? Like,
so every time you're kind of like sitting there and you're just self-improving, you keep going and it just becomes better because you do it more.
Exactly,
as
yeah.
As simple as that. Yeah.
Literally that. Like, there's no secret, unfortunately.
So when we were talking earlier about, like, self-critique and kind of just realizing that you can always get better, so how do you handle critique and self? Do you have people that – do you have go-to people that you're sending your tracks to and – that are honest with you and telling you this is shit, this is good, whatever? And how do you handle that?
Yeah, I mean, now I do. I didn't for a long time. I was really hard on myself to figure out like what's good and what's not. I needed to do that because I didn't have anyone to bounce ideas off. Now I have a team that I can send it to, and they'll give me an honest opinion. That's the reason I send it to them. I don't want people to be like, hey, this is great. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't help at all, right? So the people that I have around me are really honest about it, and sometimes they'll say something's great but I'll hate it, like, and go back and redo the whole thing, and then it'll become shit and they'll be like, dude, it was better the first time. So it's always like you got to balance, like, one, are you comfortable with what you're creating, because at the end of the day it's like your name on it, and two, you know, like, art is meant to be — it's different, so everyone has an opinion on it. Mm.
So in regards to that, to your current album, is there any tracks that you've made twice?
First, and made the album?
Yeah, for the album, like, is there any song that you made, went back, changed it all again, remade it, and every single song.
Yeah, I think there's 10 versions at minimum for every single song.
Oh, my God.
And then for dance...
Like, major or, like... 10, like, would you say, like, 10 with, like, slight changes? Or is there
huge, major changes? Yeah,
from
slight
left
changes
to right.
There's probably like over 100 changes. Oof. On like the old joke of like engineering and producing is when you export the file and you're like finished, mm-hmm. and it's like finish one and then finish two, finish 48, and you just keep going. It's maybe it'll be finished someday, but like it'll never actually finish.
Yeah, one day it will be. Do you think you ever, have you ever noticed that you went back, you changed something, boom, and oh well, you kind of just mentioned, you go back and you're like, wow, that change was actually awful.
Terrible idea. Yeah,
yeah, why did I do that?
Yeah, exactly.
So the last thing before we close out the show, I want to kind of go back again to basketball.
Yeah.
So your dream, obviously, as you're, you know, you played in a very prestigious high school. You played Division One basketball. You were actually on a lot of news stories in Albanian news stories, like basketball player to watch for in America.
Yeah.
Albanian basketball player to watch for in Albania. I mean, in America. So tell me about like the fact that when you're getting to a certain point, because you even had aspirations to play in Europe. So you're getting to a point where this is your dream, and then you kind of stop this whole dream to pursue this other dream.
Yeah.
So just talk a little bit about that and, you know, being okay with maybe this is not what I want to do for the rest, even though that's you growing up until that point. And then
for
you
sure.
just,
the
boom, I'm
going to
start and start this dream from the beginning, you know, versus I got this far in this one. Now I'm just going to stop all that and start from the beginning another direction.
For sure. I think there's two things. One was I quit basketball my junior year in college. Most people don't
really
actually know that.
Wow.
So I had two additional years to play. Hmm. I knew a week after I met Roberta Flack that, like, I just needed somebody to tell me, like, somebody that wasn't myself. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds ridiculous, but somebody
you were like super confident, Edan over there back then. So Edan over there. So obviously you were always like, I'm the fucking shit. You know,
I'm the shit. It was more of like, I love music and I'm going to get really good by practicing and getting better. So it wasn't like I was the shit in the sense of like, I knew I sucked. Like, But my confidence, when I say confidence, is I knew that I would get better.
Oh, okay. So it's the confidence of I can do this, not the confidence of like I'm doing this.
Oh, yeah. No, I wasn't confident in myself as like I'm great at this. Mm-hmm. It was I'm going to become like ridiculously good at this because mm-hmm. I'm just going to put as many hours as I humanly can. Mm-hmm. And then like literally a week or two after I met Roberta Flack, I was like, got it. That's it. Like. Mm. Totally understand.
Someone just told me, like, well, not just someone.
Not just somebody. Not just but someone, like,
yeah. They're saying you have this and now is pointing out at the talents that you didn't even know you had. Yeah. You didn't even know that's why you were good.
Exactly.
So now she's kind of putting it together and gave you that extra push to
literally,
I'm going to be a musician. Exactly. I am a musician now.
And you know what it was? Growing up, I was around some of the best NBA players, some like LeBron James Camp and, you know, Kyrie Irving mm-hmm. and all these ridiculous NBA players.
Right.
And I never got excited about it. It's weird to say, like, mm-hmm. it was nice to meet all these people, but like there was nothing exciting about playing basketball to me, like in the way that music is.
Yeah.
Because with basketball, it was always super competitive and it was always like, I want to beat this person. Like I didn't meet LeBron and say, this guy is like the most amazing human being. Like he is. Don't get me wrong. It's like my mentality was like, I want to play LeBron 1-on-1 right now and like destroy him.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
That's never gonna happen. Like, never gonna happen. But like that was my mentality. And with music, it was like I took a step back every single time I met someone talented. I was like, wow, this person does something incredibly beautiful. Like there's nothing competitive.
So everything was kind of like inspiring you to be better. It wasn't like I want to be better than this person. It was like, wow.
Exactly.
Look how great they are at this. Let me try to
get better so I can, you know, when I perform, someone can feel the way that I feel when they watch me. So that was my mentality. And seeing that and like feeling that emotionally, I was like, I don't want the rest of my life being like, I want to destroy somebody else. It's, I want to inspire other people and I want people to feel the way that I do. And I knew that music was that for me. So I was like, all right. I walked into my coach's office. I was like, sorry.
You were obviously there on a scholarship, no?
Yeah. But I had a 4.0 GPA, so they just gave me an academic scholarship and kept me in school.
4.0 GPA, basketball player, full scholarship, two full scholarships. Well, fuck you, bro. No, I'm kidding. my mom wishes I had a 4.0 GPA. No, I'm kidding. But that's amazing. So you still were able to, you know, you're doing great in school, obviously, so you're still able to not lose the money because that's obviously huge.
Of course, I would have kept playing if I had not gotten an academic scholarship.
And then, so what's the coach's reaction? Because, you know, at that point, I believe you were starting.
I didn't tell him about music. I was like...
So you were just like, I'm just quitting basketball. Were you starting at that point at St. Francis? Or?
No, I wasn't.
Because you were at St. Francis, right?
Yeah. I wasn't. I did get an offer to play professional basketball, and then I got offered to play... for Kosovo's national team, which was really sick. And
that's awesome. Yep.
Performing for an Olympic team is pretty freaking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that didn't excite me in the sense that like sitting in a room playing piano with somebody else was far more exciting to me than, you know, than the Olympics. Like think about that logically. It's like,
what?
Exactly.
What are you talking about? Sense. What are you telling me right now?
It doesn't make any sense.
Especially because every kid, like every male kid kind of like gravitates towards sports anyway.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's like when they see sports, like, oh my God, I want to be in the Olympics. I want to be in the NBA championship. So now you're kind of just starting to realize like, oh, this is not for me. And just, I'm sure it was hard to give up.
Hard conversation. For many hard people,
for everybody around you is like, bro, what are you
doing?
Like you've been putting in so much work to just give it up. And you're like,
I haven't touched a basketball since. Like,
get the hell out of here,
dude!
Time to play in 1-on-1, guys. This is the time.
This is your moment.
This is my moment.
Like, maybe I'll play like once a year, like if that.
Yeah.
But people, and it's always because somebody else wants to play. Like, it's never like a me wanting to play. For me, like I can spend every second of just my day music. Just playing music.
Yeah.
And I'll never get tired of it. And, you know, like basketball, like. If I can give something up in a day, which is I walked into my coach's office and didn't touch a basketball for like 3 years after that.
And then that was it.
That was it. For everybody else, I was like panicking and freaking out. Like, dude, you spent your whole life doing this and like you're about
I'll spend the rest of my life doing something else, I guess.
I'm going to live my life the way I want to live it, you know? Like,
so like every musician, you know, once you put something out, people consume it, and then they're waiting for the next thing.
For sure.
You know, so we always kind of ask this question on the show is, what's next? You know, in regards
this
to that
podcast.
Besides this pod, this amazing podcast.
This fantastic.
Five stars. Yeah. what is next for you? I mean, we talked about the film scores. We talked about Amazon. We talked about the Hulu. Yeah. But what's the next plan for you? Is there another album already in the works? Talk a little bit about what we're going to see from it.
For sure. There is another album. It's not going to come out for a little while. Mm-hmm. Just because I haven't lived enough life between the last album and the next one that I want to release, because it's really personal and, you know, I write stories about myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put out collaboration projects for the first time. I'm going to be working with some pretty cool artists. And, you know,
just, anybody you want to shout out?
Not just yet.
Almost got him.
Not just yet. Because the thing is, like, you want to put out a song and then the business side of it gets into it. Like,
well, yeah.
As much as you love the artist that you're working with, you also have to love their lawyer and you have to love their manager. Mm. You know? Well, you don't actually have to love their manager and lawyer, but you have to get along with them so that the song can be released. Right. And sometimes, you know, no matter how good the song or how good the collaboration
might not be
is,
released because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
With that being said, everyone, make sure to tune in to the Questionable Behavior podcast. Google us. Go click. Oh, subscribe. Subscribe one of these corners in the video. You have to click and subscribe. Check us out on Instagram at @_QBPC. And also make sure to tune in to Edan's latest album, For Marita. Edan, tell everybody your Instagram, you know, your shout outs, your last minute. This is the last chance you get to talk on camera.
Cool. be kind to each other. I think that's most important. And then just follow me if you'd like. It's at @EDONM.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. And you'll be seeing us shortly with much more interviews to come. And you're going to see actually Penthouse Views is a new show coming out. Edan is featured on that. We're wrapping that project up now, and hopefully by March, everybody will be able to tune into that as well. Thanks again, and subscribe.